From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Stories of mass killing, rape, and starvation from Sudan. Just last month, it seemed the country had made real headway. The North and South agreed to end two decades of civil war in which more than 2 million Sudanese were killed. But a new killing spree rages in the West in the region called Darfur. This one 15 months old and just as violent. Already, tens of thousands of black farmers and tribespeople have died at the hands of Arab militiamen linked to Sudan's army and the government in Khartoum. And once again, 10 years after Rwanda, the world's commitment to opposing genocide is on trial. Tonight on Point, crisis in Sudan, the cry of genocide, and the world's response. We turn first to Washington, where Ambassador Michael Renneberger, the State Department's special advisor on Sudan, who's been leading U.S. efforts to pressure Khartoum, was at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing today on Sudan. I asked him what the senators heard as Darfur burns.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee held the hearing principally to focus on the problem in Darfur in western Sudan. And the committee chairman and members expressed grave concern over the horrendous violence and atrocities which are occurring there. They asked if, in fact, this was genocide. They urged that the administration take all possible steps to stop the violence and express their concerns about getting humanitarian relief to the people.
And what did they hear? How bad is it? Is it genocide?
We described how serious the humanitarian crisis is. There are literally close to 1 million people who've been displaced inside Darfur, who are in IDP camps or who are simply out in the wild without shelter. The rains have come, so many of those people are in imminent danger and will, in fact, die in the coming weeks and months unless humanitarian assistance gets to them. The government has, under pressure, they have taken some steps to relax visa requirements for international aid workers and to relax travel restrictions.
This is the government in Khartoum?
Government, yes, mm-hmm. Of Sudan and Khartoum. They have not done nearly enough. There are still quite a number of obstacles at the local level in Darfur. In addition, of course, the violence that's being perpetrated by these so-called Janjaweed militia, who are supported by the government, make it impractical in many areas to deliver humanitarian assistance. Now, what we have said on the situation is that what has happened there, what the government has done in Darfur over the past months, does in fact constitute ethnic cleansing. Systematically, African ethnic groups have been targeted in Darfur, and they have been systematically forced off the land through violence and atrocities, again, perpetrated by these Janjaweed militia who are controlled and coordinated by the government in most cases. The Secretary of State himself has indicated that we are looking at the issue of whether this constitutes genocide. That's I would not go beyond that at this point. What we have said is it clearly is ethnic cleansing, and we are keeping it under very close review to identify if and when it appears to be more than that.
Michael Renneberger, is the United States, is the world at risk of repeating the Rwanda scenario where while people dither over the word genocide, the genocide goes ahead and happens?
Well, I think what's very important to state is whether you call it ethnic cleansing or whether you call it genocide, we, the United States, are acting, and we have been acting for quite a few months now. We've been acting ever since the dimensions of this problem became clear. We have taken a tremendous number of actions to exert pressure on the government of Sudan to take the necessary steps in Darfur to stop the violence, to allow humanitarian access, and to allow international monitoring of the situation. And that pressure has had results. Under pressure, the government signed a ceasefire agreement with the Darfur opposition. Under pressure, they have allowed international monitors in, and under pressure, they've taken these very limited actions on humanitarian assistance. So we think that it is essential to maintain and increase, as necessary, pressure on the government to do this. We are also, of course, working intensively with European and African countries to send a unified message to the Sudanese government that it simply must stop what is occurring in Darfur.
Well, President Bush said in April that this killing needs to immediately stop. It clearly has not anything like entirely stopped. What else can the United States do, the UN do, European allies do? What remains to be done?
That's correct. It has not stopped, and in fact, I would say that such there has been some perhaps marginal, limited improvement in the situation, but there is still a tremendous amount of violence and atrocities, and we still can't get out the humanitarian assistance. So it's a very, very severe problem. Since, in fact, those statements were made, we have continued to steadily increase the pressure. We've had now three briefings that the United States has taken the lead in organizing in the United Nations Security Council in Darfur, which has resulted most recently in a very strong statement by the Security Council. We also co-sponsored and passed a resolution last week in the Security Council that, in fact, covers both Darfur and the North-South peace process and indicates that the Security Council will keep that issue under review. We intend, if the government does not take the necessary steps immediately, we intend to push for a UN Security Council resolution against the government. At the same time, I want to be very clear that we have told the government, and we told the government this months ago, that we will not normalize relations with it as long as this violence in Darfur continues, even if they sign this North-South peace agreement. Mm-hmm. So we are maintaining quite strong pressure. We are also looking very actively at the accountability issue. How do we hold people in the Sudanese government who've been responsible for these atrocities and violence, how do we hold them accountable?
Ambassador Renneberger, let me just ask you, is the world going to get it right this time in Darfur, in Sudan, or is it already too late to make that claim, however this turns out?
I do not think this is a repeat of the Rwanda situation. I do think that the world has learned some lessons on that, and one of those is the need to act early so that it does not develop into a massive situation of genocide. And in this case, in fact, the United States, and I think we can all, and this has nothing to do with me, this has to do with the U.S. government, and I only work as part of a broad team, but I think we should all be proud that the U.S. government really has exerted leadership. We were the first country, really, to insist that this go before the Security Council. We were the first country to really sound the alarm bell about what was happening in Darfur. So we have helped to energize the world community. And I do think that that pressure that's being exerted and that's being intensified will eventually turn the corner in Darfur. And as you say, the sad reality is that there are tremendous numbers of people at risk right now.
A last question. Andrew Natsios, the head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, said Thursday in Geneva, Switzerland, that as many as 1 million may die if aid doesn't get to them soon. What does the clock look like here? How soon does decisive action have to take place to stop and resupply to avoid that kind of death?
I'm not a humanitarian expert, but the situation is that the humanitarian aid, even though it's going into the provincial capitals, there are three provincial capitals in Darfur, it is difficult to get that aid out to the real outlying areas because, first of all, the government is posing obstacles at the local level. Secondly, the violence itself that's occurring on the ground hampers that. So it is, in fact, the case that we can't get the humanitarian aid to nearly as many people as needed. And, in fact, there will be substantial deaths if we cannot improve that situation very, very quickly. The race right now is to see how quickly we can pre-position the humanitarian aid and get it out to people. USAID has done an enormous amount on this. They have already committed or spent in Darfur $95 million providing humanitarian assistance. In Geneva, at this meeting that Andrew Natsios was at, they pledged an additional $188 million. So we've pledged or have contributed already about $300 million. We are by far the largest humanitarian donor. People are dying, and as the clock ticks and time goes on, more and more people will die. That's why we're working with such urgency to stop the violence and get the humanitarian assistance out.
And the clock ticks on. Ambassador Michael Renneberger, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Ambassador Michael Renneberger, the State Department's Special Advisor on Sudan. We're talking tonight about the crisis in Sudan and how the United States and the rest of the international community should respond. Have you heard the stories of the massacres, the rapes, the starvation? Is this genocide? And if it is, what should be done? Do you want an activist U.S. government quick to intervene? Or with Iraq and Afghanistan, is there already enough on Washington's plate? Can we ever look away from genocide? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Jennifer Leaning, professor of international health at Harvard University's School of Public Health. She just returned from a trip to the Chad-Sudan border with Physicians for Human Rights. Good evening and welcome, Jennifer Leaning.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Tell us exactly where you were.
We traveled in a two-person team with Physicians for Human Rights from N'Djamena, the capital, which is on the western edge of Chad, all the way to the eastern border with Darfur, which is a two-hour day trip. And by plane, it is much faster. And then to that provincial town called Abeche, it's overland by Land Rover to the eastern border. We traveled several thousand kilometers to get to the north, central, and south part of that border and interviewed refugees along the border and in camps.
And take us into what you saw, and perhaps more importantly, because you could not cross the border into Sudan, what you heard from the refugees in those camps.
What we saw was some fraction of the estimated 200,000 refugees who have now crossed the border into Chad in desperate flight from what's occurring in Darfur. About half of them have now been moved into camps by UNHCR and the humanitarian organizations somewhat distant from the border because the Janjaweed, the Arab militias in Darfur, are harassing people on the border. The other 100,000 are still scattered in what's called self-settlement up and down the border. Some of them are getting access to humanitarian relief. Some of them, and here we're talking about tens of thousands, have not yet even been seen by the humanitarian community. And the worst situation is in the northern part of the eastern border of Chad. There are about 18,000 refugees in a place called Bahai, which is very hot, desert area, very remote, and extremely forbidding circumstances for life, even for people who are somewhat acclimatized to that area.
These among the people that we understand are at risk of death, if not immediately, then in a matter of weeks or months. And the stories you heard from the other side of that border, Dr. Leaning?
Well, the stories from the various refugee camps, and as we talk to people along the road who are still self-settled, the stories are very consistent, and they reflect an organized, in our view, intent on the part of the government Sudan working with the Janjaweed militia to drive African, black African, indigenous farmers and semi-animal husbandry economy-based peoples out of the country of Darfur into regions of Chad or into urban enclave areas within Darfur. It's a deracination campaign. What they're doing is destroying the villages, destroying the farmland, hauling away all the cattle and livestock and camels, burning everything they can find, destroying the irrigation works, killing the men who resist, raping the women that they find, and terrorizing people so that they flee and abandon homesteads that they've held for generations.
Did they describe this to you in detail? Did you hear how it happens?
Yeah.
What goes on?
Yeah, it's eerie. In these villages, which are already pressed because of desertification and drought, the young women and girls tend to go out in the early morning to collect firewood and gather water. The Janjaweed, as a sign of their assault on the village, begin to surround and attack and rape these young women as they're outside the village protection. The young women come back, tell the story. People are unsettled for a day or so. Then airplanes come in, fixed-wing Antonovs. These are government of Sudan airplanes or maybe helicopters doing surveillance. Occasionally, they will drop a crude bomb, but the killing doesn't come from the airplanes. It's just the fear. And then that is followed by an early morning raid by the Janjaweed, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of them. Some of these villages are relatively big, and the forces are big. They come out on horseback or in vehicles, and then they systematically start at one end of the village, and they kill, rape, pillage, and destroy, and they mow down the village till they reach the other end. And people flee. The men actually go first because, as they said, they know that they will be killed. And the worst case, as they have come to expect, is that the women may only be raped. Now, in a culture where it's very gender-defined and the men are very protective of women, you can get a sense of how extreme the circumstance is where the men routinely flee in advance of the Janjaweed.
And leave the women and children because it's just that bad. And
yes,
it seems to be working. They are depopulating this part of Sudan.
They're depopulating Darfur.
By your estimation, and we don't want to get tangled up in words, and still we need to know, is this genocide?
The Genocide Convention is, you know well, is vague on how you actually have empirical facts to prove what you think might be intent to annihilate and haul or impart a people. But in our view, this is a destruction of livelihood. And these are farmers. and it's some killing, massive disruption of capacity to live. We think it is unfolding genocide.
Jennifer Leaning, stand by. We're talking tonight about the crisis in Sudan, the cry of genocide, and the world's response. Have you heard the stories out of Sudan, the massacres, the rape, the starvation? Is this genocide? What should be done? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is... This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the crisis in Sudan, the cry of genocide there, and the world's response. My guest tonight is Jennifer Leaning, professor of international health at Harvard University's School of Public Health. She's just returned from the Chad-Sudan border with Physicians for Human Rights. You can join our conversation tonight. What is the world's responsibility when violence turns to ethnic cleansing, turns to genocide? Should the UN be handling this? Can it handle this? What should the U.S. be doing? What more should it be doing? Will the global instinct always be to turn away because it's costly, because it's ugly, because it's difficult? What does it take to make you an interventionist? A photograph, a terrible story, a moment of imagining it might be you. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Leaning, your crew brought some tape back from the border with Sudan. And I want to hear a bit of this and then have you tell us more about it. But as I understand, this is John Heffernan with Physicians for Human Rights. Here, this is tape of him asking a 35-year-old mother of four from western Darfur in Sudan to tell the story of how her village was attacked by government-backed Arab militiamen and what happened when she fled. He talked to her in a refugee camp called Farshana across the border in Chad. Let's listen.
Now, I'd like to ask her a few questions about why she left Dawit.
We were attacked by the government. They were wearing military uniforms. They came on horseback and with camels. Some were in cars. They also had two military helicopters.
What time of day was this?
It was almost 5 o'clock in the morning. We had no warning.
No warning? Okay. And so did these Sudanese military come into her house?
Four of the military men came into my house. They took all my property out, and then they burned the house. After that, we ran away. My husband fled first. Then I ran away with my four children. After we left the village, we escaped into the forest. We hid there until night, and then we crossed the border to Mahamata. We took nothing with us. It took 7 hours to walk from the forest to the border. We were on foot.
While she was still in Duat, her village, did she see anything else that these Sudanese military forces were doing? Did she see anybody killed? Did she see any sort of people wounded or any other type of activity that they inflicted upon these people?
Some people died, some ran away, some were wounded. They killed my sister and her daughter. My sister was 40, her baby was 3. She was running away with the baby on her back. They shot them both with a machine gun.
So what are her hopes for the future?
When we lived in the village, we had money, we had property. We were farmers, we had food. Now we've lost everything. We have to start from nothing in a foreign land. We hope that other people will help us because we don't have any money. We have nothing.
The voice of Sudan, collected there by John Heffernan with Physicians for Human Rights. His colleague Jennifer Leaning is with me in the studio. There's just one story out of tens of thousands, out of hundreds of thousands. Where are we in the arc of this crisis? Is it still at full boil?
Yes, I think it's still at full boil. A key problem is we really don't know what's happening in Darfur. The Sudanese government is leading people around by the nose. They're restricting access to vast swaths of that country. Even the people that are getting in, including humanitarians and the USAID DART teams, are only going where the government lets them go. So this figure of a million that are displaced and at high risk, I think, is hand-waving. We actually don't know how many people are in dire circumstances or where they are. So we are in one of these problems of ascertainment and data gathering where I think part of the responsibility of the United States and the international community needs to be organized at finding out the facts in addition to saying something deplorable is going on. We have to require access to Darfur, full, unfettered, thorough access.
Enough with the hand-waving. Something needs to be done here.
Yes.
Jennifer Leaning, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Samantha Power, also with us in the studio tonight. She's a lecturer in public policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. She was founding executive director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. She's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide. Samantha Power, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You have watched genocide and studied genocide in the Balkans, in Rwanda. What do you see happening in Sudan, Samantha?
Well, something, if it isn't genocide, it's certainly very close. We're definitely in the red zone, long past the time where we should be as an international community banding together to do far more than dispatch humanitarian aid and plead ritually every 2 weeks or so in Geneva for humanitarian access. I think that the signs, as Jennifer has indicated, are extremely worrying. One, humanitarian aid is being blocked explicitly. It's a
deliberately
policy
by the government.
Deliberately.
In
okay. So this is on the heels of all that she has described and all that the tape recorded in terms of the terror being inflicted on the citizens of Darfur, the Africans of Darfur. So when you're blocking aid and when you know that people who have been deported from their homes cannot survive without eating or without water, this is an intent actually to see those people killed, even if you remain one step removed from the actual killing. It will look conveniently more like death by natural causes. The second worrying sign, now that aid workers are increasingly being permitted into Darfur because of some pressure from the outside, but is that now the aid itself is being blocked. So you now have aid workers finally deploying within Darfur, not nearly enough.
But the food doesn't follow with the medical
equipment. But the food need, 15 permits, in order to clear customs. And the third worrying sign, and this is something that I think we too often forget about, is journalists. No permission whatsoever to access Darfur. And that's why all of us are having this conversation so much in the abstract. We're lucky to get the voices from Jennifer and from John from the border.
Yes.
But one of the reasons the political constituency that exists out there is for now quite latent and quite confused and debating in the realm of UN Security Council resolutions is that there is nothing moving this up atop the agenda near Abu Ghraib and Iraq and all of the other things, obviously, that are cluttering people's plate, not only in government, not only in international institutions, but also with non-governmental groups.
So we don't want to take our eyes off of what's actually happening there, though it's hard to see, as you say, because people just can't get in, even journalists. But while we look at that, we want to learn about why this has happened. Give us your report card, Samantha Power, on the U.S. government and the U.N., first of all. What ought to be happening? What should have happened? What isn't happening? What has worked here?
Well, I think Ambassador Ranenberger said one thing that is true and important, and that is that the Bush administration has been more forthright about this, I would say, than the Clinton administration was during the Rwandan genocide, but also far more spirited in its efforts than the Europeans, than senior UN officials like the Secretary General. And for that, I suppose, one can applaud the U.S. government. But the focus is distinctly humanitarian. The desire to treat this or to treat the symptoms of what is ultimately a political crisis and a top-down, Khartoum-driven effort to destroy an ethnic group as such, the focus on getting aid access misses the point in a central way, which is aid access is not going to be granted when the government is intent on wiping out a group.
Or so what does that mean? Another opportunity for regime change here? Is that what it takes, or something else entirely?
I think one has to. There's a continuum of intervention available at all times. And first thing I think that is worth saying is that it is essential that the response to this be international. more than American because of the issue of U.S. legitimacy in the wake of the Iraq War, because of the Bush administration's relationship to international institutions, et cetera. So one thing that I would say is that Kofi Annan, despite issuing a strong statement on the 10-year anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, has been largely mute over the course of the last 2 months. Now, there is word that he is heading to the region and hopefully will get into Darfur, maybe on his heels. He will bring human rights monitors and others and secure a much more forceful presence on the ground. But that is step number one. There has to be international leadership and more than just a U.S. effort, again, to secure humanitarian access. Step two, the issue of accountability. Kofi Annan also has within his power, as does the Security Council, the capacity to commission a high-level investigation into whether, as Jennifer said, this is genocide, whether these are crimes against humanity, where they've been carried out. So far, believe it or not, all of the international hand-wringing has yielded only one substantial deployment to Darfur, and that is the deployment of 90 African Union monitors who are there not to monitor the human rights situation, but to monitor a ceasefire between local rebels and the Janjaweed militia.
And this in a huge area, an area the size of France or something.
So 90 monitors, 60 of whom are armed, 30 unarmed. This is not a meaningful presence that would allow the million or so refugees to return to their homes, to rebuild their livelihood. They will die if they are left in flight.
So I know you've got more, but let me ask you on these two fronts then. A, why hasn't the United States intervened beyond a humanitarian level? And B, why a mute Kofi Annan, African Secretary General of the United Nations?
Well, I think that partly it's because Kofi Annan has a sense of what member states are and are not willing to do. I mean, he knows there is not an appetite to deploy peacekeepers into harm's way and to make war on behalf of mere genocide. I hate to put it that way, but that is ultimately how member states have made their choices over the years. On the Bush administration side, one of the things President Bush did very early on in office out of response to his Christian constituency in this country was took very high-level ownership and leadership on the North-South peace process in Sudan.
And this was much more Arab v. Christian.
Exactly. And so I think that the reluctance to kind of beat Khartoum over the head on two issues at once really undermined the desire to put political pressure on Khartoum.
On this Western front, where they're not Christians but Africans, some Muslims and animists, whatever you have in Darfur.
Exactly. So it was a sort of walk and chew gum at the same time problem. But the thing that one has to stress, again, without making a false dichotomy between doing nothing on the one hand or trying to feed people on the one hand and sending in the Marines on the other, there has not even been a cabinet meeting in the U.S. government about what should be done, about what are the steps short, let's say, of military intervention, about the kind of logistic support that the United States might be able to supply to a much more robust monitoring presence, even if it's an unarmed presence, if that's all that Khartoum will allow. But the pressure on Khartoum has only been around the issue of humanitarian access, and that, number one, it's being blocked anyway, so that's not actually producing dividends, but it has not been on the accountability side, and it has been exceedingly credulous and exceedingly willing to kind of take the scraps that Khartoum has to offer and to kind of call that a victory at
which
a press conference.
Which means the world still doesn't have its act together to handle this kind of crisis.
Yes, that would be
manifestly
what it means.
Right in front of us.
Yes, I don't think there's any question. And we now have a tendency to say, you know, coalitions of the willing should do the job. You know, the UN isn't equipped to do the job. The United States, of course, is preoccupied. But if we turn to the African Union, here you have an entity which, again, is deploying these 90 monitors for a province the size of France, but that really fundamentally is not anxious to interfere in the internal affairs of a sovereign state, even if it's something bordering on genocide.
Which raises all kinds of questions about the UN as well. There's much more we want to hear here, but a lot of callers want to join our conversation. I want to turn to them. Peter's calling from Boston. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
How are you? Nice to talk to you.
Yeah.
Let me say this. I love your program. I like the concerned questions you're posing. I just don't want to, you know, come across as ranting because I'm angry. Simply because what's going on in Sudan right now, I have myself experienced personally as a kid in Nigeria, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, we're sitting over here discussing what's genocide and what's not. That is pure genocide that's going on in Sudan. When a particular group an ethnic group determines and plans to deliberately eliminate another group, What else do you call that? That is genocide. And what I see happening in Sudan was exactly what happened in Biafra. I was a kid. Do you remember Biafra?
Biafra, of course, in the 70s.
That's exactly what's happening.
So Peter, what should be done in your view? Okay, let's stop debating whether or not it's genocide. What should happen?
What should happen now? You know what should happen? What should happen is this. Short of military intervention by the U.S., they should sack the Sudanese embassy here in America, restrict visa entry for Sudanese officials. Every practical measure to convey to them the seriousness of their concern over what's happening in Sudan. Nothing else. So, short of sacking the government in Sudan, just as what happened in Iraq today, I mean, that's where this whole operation should be directed.
So find the pressure points and work on those pressure points and do it like you mean business. Peter, we've got it. Jennifer Leaning, I see you nodding along there.
I agree that the pressure needs to be exerted by the United States and by the Europeans and hopefully by the Arab League and the United Nations.
What is the
on
pressure?
The government? Well, the government of Sudan is a big government. It's a tightly organized, oppressive government. It is also a player in the international community and about to become a bigger one because of the North-South Peace Agreement. There are
which was to rehabilitate them on the world stage.
Well, yes, but that also gives us some opportunity. Restriction of visas, restriction of bank accounts, naming some names,
bank
calling
accounts
to account.
Of the nation, of particular leaders within the nation?
Particular leaders. I mean, I think we need to start getting real. Who are the head of the Janjaweed? Who are the sort of corporals and colonels in the government of Sudan army that are out there? What is being handled in terms of the foreign ministry there? What are they doing in terms of their...
So don't sit back like it's some kind of immoral thing, but get in there and figure out who's responsible for what and put the pressure on those individual persons.
Begin by recognizing not that this is a government doing something legitimate about a skirmish in its western border, but that this is a government that is malignantly intent on wiping out a subset of its population. And from that stance, say that it won't be allowed in the international community. There are a lot of ways short of a peacekeeping force, although that may be necessary. As Samantha said, there are a lot of ways where the United States and Europe could make life distinctly unpleasant and embarrassing for the government of Sudan, and we haven't done it.
Peter, does that sound like a beginning to you?
Can I say something?
Yes, please.
Yeah, you know, let me tell you, the entire African Union constitutes merely almost 90% of Arab countries, and for them, it is they could not conceive of stopping a fellow Arab country from doing whatever they deem or they want to do. That was the case in Nigeria. Now, talk about the UN. Just as Samantha Powers pointed out there, Kofi Annan knows where the powers lie in Africa. He doesn't want to rattle the boat. He does not want to do that. You know, it's evil. It's evil of the worst kind going on in Sudan today. And we're sitting here, trying to define what's genocide and what that is pure genocide. I experienced it firsthand in Biafra. It's happening in Sudan today.
Peter, we've got it, and we're trying to push past the words and towards something closer to action. But we thank you for your call, Samantha Power. What does this mean? Does it mean that the United Nations is just structurally incapable of addressing the very kind of problem that we would think they should be first to address?
Well, first let me agree with Peter that we should just avoid the semantic debate and just move to what is happening to the people on the ground and just your mm-hmm. question, Tom, which is what on earth can we do and who will be willing to do what. Second, on the question of the United Nations, what is the United Nations exactly? I mean, the United Nations is basically, not entirely, but basically a building. Blaming the United Nations is like blaming Fenway Park when the Red Sox don't play well, to a large extent. Who are the states that comprise the United Nations? What are they willing to do? And Kofi Annan can use his moral authority to prod them and to urge them to contribute peacekeepers to a peacekeeping mission or to use their bilateral pressure on states.
We'll come right back and look at that. Samantha Power, Jennifer Leaning, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the crisis in Sudan, the cry of genocide, and the world's response. People are dying now. Is there a moral justification for hanging back? We're 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the crisis in Sudan, the cry of genocide, and the world's response. You can join the conversation. Is the world's commitment to stopping genocide rhetorical, or is it real? What should it be? And what does it take to make you an interventionist? A photograph, a terrible story, a moment of imagining it might be you. What should be done in Sudan. My guest tonight, Jennifer Leaning. She just returned from the Chad-Sudan border with Physicians for Human Rights. And Samantha Power, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. Sheila is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Sheila. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
My grandson happens to be working for Doctors Without Borders, and he's down in the southern part of by the White Nile, which is below Darfur. But he's getting all the refugees, and he's killing himself trying to take care of all these kids who die before they can. They're so starving from malnutrition that they die before they can even treat them. And
what does he tell you his grandmother should happen there?
What?
What does he say should happen?
Well, he's upset because a lot of people from Darfur were kicked out because of visa violations, which is due to Khartoum. And I don't know. I mean, I think we're not paying enough attention to all the nations in Africa or all at war. I think it's time we paid attention to all these countries. He's having a very hard time dealing with all these things. He's doing his best. But frankly, I think the UN is something that needs to do it. But if you, having read a book about Rwanda and Srebrenica, they let people down all the time there. We've got to form a better way of dealing with these people who do ethnic cleansing. And we're not doing it. Instead, the only reason we're interested in Sudan is because of oil. The only thing I know is that Bush recently exempted Sudan from a terrorist list because they want because of oil.
It sounds like you know a good.
Because of oil.
It sounds like you know a good deal more than that, Sheila. And you put your finger on a lot here. Let us pick that up. And good luck to your grandson in Sudan. Samantha Power, you said just before the break, the UN is just a building, but I don't think that's entirely true. It's a structure. It's an idea. It's supposed to function. Yes, it's made up of member states, but. But is this evidence that we've got a fundamentally flawed structure there, or is this, at bottom, really just the reluctance of the member nations to do anything about something like this?
Well, I would have said that it is primarily a building, and it is a place that states come to point fingers at other states and to do largely what their national interests is seen to dictate. However, Kofi Annan and the secretariat that he presides over has moral authority. It has agenda-setting authority. It has showing up and humiliating member states authority, shaming authority. It can commission the investigation, you know, on war crimes, et cetera. So there is, under the Secretary General's command and domain, I think, real power.
And
power
you're describing as mute. If that's not used, what does that mean?
Exactly. But when one contrasts that power, substantial though it is, relative to our power here sitting around a table, with the power of member states that have contracts, that have embassy bilateral diplomatic relations, that have military training relations, that foreign investment possibilities, I mean, one can see that there is that enough, as it were, blame to go around. And I think one of the things that one should say about the United Nations before we go too much further, because this has actually just come to my attention, but UN peacekeeping now is up at the highest level it has ever been in its history in terms of the numbers of UN peacekeepers that are deployed in Congo, in Liberia, in Ivory Coast, in Burundi, and soon in southern Sudan. You have 70,000 peacekeepers now from a number of member states sort of sprinkled all over the globe in the worst places. They are being manned in New York under the Secretary General's kind of command by 600 staffers. Now, no military, worth the name, would ever deploy 70,000 troops with only 600 kind of secretaries and logisticians to back them up in the home country. UN peacekeeping right now is very, very overstretched. And it's overstretched for a simple reason that Sudan only underscores, which is that member states, especially Western powers, do not want to contribute peacekeepers do not want to contribute money on behalf of mere humanitarian suffering, something that can be bracketed and that doesn't seem relevant to the war on terrorism or to security and economic interests.
Is this problem then going to require military intervention or not? Jennifer Leaning saying, go for the leverage points. You're saying the same. Can it be done without sending in blue helmets?
Well, it will. The longer we wait, the more required, the greater the requirement will be if we're going to stave off a million deaths. I mean, there are those now who say that if we do everything right between now and December, 300,000 people will die, and we're not doing everything right. So there's no question that the presence on the ground, whether it's a UN presence, an African Union presence, and I agree with the prior caller that that's probably not a great idea to wait for the African Union to get excited about contributing more peacekeepers. But whatever the ground presence is, people are going to need to return to their homes if they have any chance of lasting the year. And in order for that presence to become possible, precisely the leverage points that Jennifer mentioned are going to need to be applied. That is, they go together, right? You're pressuring the government in order to secure certain outcomes. And those outcomes are ones that will have to be acted upon by specific member states, whether it's in terms of giving money or in terms of actually sending monitors to comprise this force.
Jennifer Leaning, when you look at this, what do you end up thinking about the world community? Does it exist? Is this kind of outbreak of violence and large-scale killing just something that's going to happen, like a rash, and the world just kind of waits until, puts a little salve on it and waits for it to go away? I mean, if we don't muster the organization or the will, is this just going to come again and again? We'll have this kind of conversation in 2 or 3 years about some other venue, or are we approaching the time when we get organized around this and say, no, this simply isn't acceptable, here's how we intervene?
Yeah, I think people in humanitarian organizations and in human rights work all tend to say at some level of clenched jaw hope that there is a world community. And what we are trying to do is to mobilize it to its best level of action out of its apathy and the layers of inertia that Samantha has just limed. And a part of that rousing the world to recognize that once again it has to get up off its haunches and do something about the distress of a distant population in a part of the world that no one knows how to get to. It requires people to go out there at some risk, come back with some stories. Journalists are absolutely essential. And it also requires a few people with good ears and some courage at these key powerful places in government and in international organizations to get out in front and say some of these things are absolutely unacceptable. So when we're managing towards outcomes, we have to say the killing has to stop. The deracination has to stop. There has to be access to the people that are now disrupted from livelihood. And above all, there has to be an accomplishment of return. The IDPs that are now spread all over Darfur, wherever the hell they are, they have to
be
allowed to,
the
internally displaced people,
yes.
They have to be allowed and permitted to go back to their homes, their land, not some sort of silly outpost in Nyala. They need to go back to their village.
Mm-hmm,
These
mm-hmm.
are people who are farmers.
They have homes.
They have
fields.
Homes. And similarly, the people that are in Chad, it is disrupting to Chad. Chad is desperately poor. To have 200,000 new people from a mixture of tribes that are not a great melange with the mixture of tribes that are on the Chadian side of the border, that is politically and economically unstabilizing. They need to be able to go back. So that's going to require a level of organization, commitment, coordination, and from my perspective, courage on the part of certain leaders that I think we in civil society have to demand.
There's still a sound of hope there, but an awfully big challenge, too. Ray is calling from Boston. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Tom, thank you, and just want to say that I really appreciate your keeping this issue in front of the public. My thanks also to Samantha Powers and also to the Physicians for Human Rights.
All good work.
I've had the privilege of going twice and my wife 5 times to southern Sudan, and what's striking to me is the way in which the Sudanese government has played the world community like a fiddle for 2 decades.
What do you mean by that, Ray?
I think they have counted on the fact that, as Samantha's talked about, that the world community considers humanitarian crises to be a secondary, if not tertiary, concern.
Mm-hmm.
They've counted on the fact that the expectation is that it's just another civil war in Africa. They've counted on the fact that in many cases, until there was something that was compelling, and I think in many respects what elevated southern Sudan was the discovery of oil 5 years ago.
Yeah.
My sense is that unless one, as Samantha's pointed out, we begin to name names, make it clear that people will be tried for war crimes, unless we begin to bring pressure on countries like China, which are benefiting from the oil and offering some political cover for Sudan, unless I think we implement some of the things that the International Crisis Group has talked about, immediately expelling Sudan from the UN Human Rights Commission. Until we begin to do these things, and it's absolutely clear to each and every government that they will face sanctions, they will face immediate consequences and repercussions.
And Ray, are you looking to the United Nations to do this, or to Washington, or to Brussels?
And Washington and the European Union, which was shamefully quiet, the European Union, in the case of southern Sudan. And I'm not hearing an awful lot from them now.
Still quiet. Ray, it sounds like you know a lot about what's going on there. We appreciate your calling in. Samantha Power, this playing like a fiddle, to what end? What is the point of these marauding bands of Janjaweed tossing out hundreds of thousands of people? Is there oil in Darfur also? Is this just a... What is the point of all this suffering?
You know, in the Nazis in the concentration camp, the Jews would say, Varum. And the Nazis would say, Darum. Varum, darum, you know, why, therefore, why, because. I mean, I think it's a little more complicated, perhaps, in Darfur. This peace agreement that is on the verge of being signed, we hope, between North and South, between Khartoum and the Christian rebels, allow for the Christians or the others in the South to potentially secede within 6 years. This is a very, very big concession. And the government, I think, fears that once it sets the precedent, that other restive regions will also push for that kind of political accommodation.
And there are rebel groups in Darfur as well.
And there is a rebel presence in Darfur that wants to be treated like something other than the poor cousin that it has been treated in terms of resources from the government, roads, and so on. And so I think that the idea, and this is a tried and true tactic by Khartoum, is you solve your autonomy problem or you solve your rebel problem by wiping out the people.
Just get rid of everybody. Get rid of the fish. Get
Drain
rid of
the sea. Yeah.
Josh is on the line. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling. I spent 20 months in southern Sudan working as a humanitarian aid worker and returned last year in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to throw in and support your guests in saying that action needs to happen now. There's been 20 years of civil war in southern Sudan. There's a lot that has gone on. There's a lot of discussion. I hear words like access, and I'm pulling my hair out because access has been discussed
forever and ever. Yeah.
I think the EU, the Americans, the UN need to move, to take charge and put pressure on Khartoum, but at the same time deliver the humanitarian aid to the bush, where as each day goes by, people are dying, and they're dying under really severe conditions, and they need that help.
So action is the word.
Action. There are plenty of people there. There are plenty of NGOs. There's a lot of folks who can be tapped who know how to move and move quickly, given their experience in southern Sudan under Operation Lifeline Sudan.
So enough with the hand-waving. Let's get in there one way or another. Josh, thanks
Preferably.
For your call. Jennifer Leaning, question for you then. It brings us back to this G word, genocide. Is it a necessary trigger to get things going, or is it just that's a debate that Samantha capsulized so perfectly, and now we're beyond it. We're looking at just what's really going on. Does it need to get that label? Would that make a difference, or is it irrelevant?
I don't think it's irrelevant. I mean, this is a convention that we walk around for the last 50 years and have large difficulty implementing. And I think when we are looking at unfolding killing and loss of livelihood and disruption of scores of thousands, if not millions of people, the word needs to come into play. And we need to figure out how to operationalize it, how to recognize it when we see it, how to look across a border and say, you know what, we think there's some unfolding indicators here, there's some lines of evidence. And it's not just an academic action. It has major policy implications because of the scores of nations, including every country we've mentioned, who are signatories to this convention and are obligated to act if the word gets into play. So I think it is important from a policy standpoint. It's also important from the way of framing this, because genocide is a crime of the most malignant intent that we have in the international arena. And if we are going to get serious and show we're serious about our stance towards the government of Sudan, this word has tremendous valence. And I would regret our not using it if on some level, we think it isn't. It's relevant.
Well,
I think it's relevant.
We've heard just how close the U.S. government has come, but not yet used. We'll be watching. We'll be listening. Jennifer Leaning, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Jennifer Leaning, professor of international health at Harvard University School of Public Health. She just returned from the Chad-Sudan border with Physicians for Human Rights. And Samantha Power, thanks so much for being with us. Samantha Power, founding executive director of the Carr Center at the Kennedy School of Government, Harvard. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.